and high. Their light grows cold as it fades away. Dreams of yesterday. And as I hold you tonight, your eyes seem 10,000 miles away. What is there to say?
Silly little girl, you just can't win. Silly little girl in love with him. And he doesn't know, he just doesn't know that you're alive.
Gray skies up above, sudden shower. Like it's been raining for hours. I just don't.
You've been hurt too much now, so you think that love is a lie. And you're so afraid if you love me, I'll just make you cry.
And joining us right now at PMP Network is Wayne Wadhams. Wayne, of course, was one of the folks from the Fifth Estate. This guy was writing their songs, and we're going to talk a little bit about the beginnings of the group and about their great success, including the number 11 hit, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, which, of course, came from The Wizard of Oz. And we're going to talk to him about that as we open up right now with Wayne. Hi, Wayne. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Good. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You and a bunch of your friends from Stamford, Connecticut, got together as teenagers and started playing some music.
Well, actually, it was two friends, and we advertised in the school newspaper for other players. I had seen the Beatles and gotten inspired like so many people and wanted to start a band. Partially to help put myself through college, but also surreptitiously just because it seemed so exciting. So We advertised and found people and tried it out, and it worked.
Now, the first group you had was, what was it called?
Initially, we called the group the D-Men.
The D-Men.
It started out to be the Demons, but somebody misprinted it on a poster as the D-Men. And then when we got a record company, they had the bright idea of changing all our names so that they began with D. I became Dwayne instead of Wayne, and et cetera, et cetera. That's the way it was in the 60s.
Everybody had to have some kind of a shtick.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, we had several shticks, as it were.
Now, the D-Men, actually, from what I have read, did a lot of commercial stuff, right? Didn't you guys have some success with that?
Well, we did. That was really, again, just by chance. When we got together, we rehearsed across the street from my house in a local bar and grill called the Paradise Bar and Grill. And one of the guys that used to come there just to drink on Friday nights was named Kevin Gavin. And he was a jingle singer in New York. And pretty well connected with the ad agencies and such. He had sung the Brill Cream commercials and various other things that most people in your audience have never heard of by now, but nevertheless, they were big things back then, and so he had a lot of contacts and got us a lot of gigs, which were very well-paying gigs at the time, to write jingles and sing on jingles and play on sessions for jingles. So that helped defray the bills while we were trying to become stars.
Exactly. And, of course, you went to Dartmouth and got an education.
Yes.
And from what some people tell me, that the version of Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead that you guys recorded for such a great hit, that you had a lot to do with, I guess your Dartmouth education had a lot to do with the way you arranged that.
Well, yes, but that was an extension of high school, really. I have to give the credit for that to my high school choir teacher, Mary Livingston, in Stamford, Connecticut, who unfortunately just passed away last year. But I dedicated when I later started my own label, Boston Skyline, and brought out a reissue of the original Renaissance piece of music that inspired Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. I dedicated that to her as an afterthought 40 years later almost. But it was from a Renaissance record which I had heard that she had played us in class and which I became enthralled with because it was just so happy. And it stuck in my mind. And when somebody bet us at some silly New Year's Eve party that we could make a rock record out of any song, and Don, our lyric writer, said, like what? And the guy at the party said, like something from The Wizard of Oz, we came up with Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, and I stuck that Renaissance piece in the middle.
So here you are, you're composing this on a bet, and it becomes the biggest hit for the group.
Well, that's the way things work in this business. You know, for a very long time, we had kind of a strange relationship with the song. The guys in the group, I must admit, had a vicarious treat out of doing it because it was just so absurd. But then when it became a hit, instead of the more legit rock that we were writing, you know, which we were pretty serious about, a couple of them resented it. So you go through periods of disliking being known for something that was just a lark rather than something you tried to do seriously, and other periods where you say, well, that's the entertainment business, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to the CD, and again, it's available through Boston Skyline, Ding Dong, the Witch is Back, the Fifth Estate, from
right.
1964 to 69. It's a great album, and I never, you know, you kind of forget how good the music was. I love 60s music anyway, and from the beginning of the CD, Love is All a Game, which is a great song, all the way through to some of the stuff that you actually wrote for other people, like Silly Little Girl, for a demo
Sheila
Back, and also My Foolish Pride for the Highwaymen, and Love Isn't Tears Only for the Righteous Brothers. There's some great music here, and it's nice that you know, people can appreciate, even at this stage, some of this music.
Well, I have to say that I was fortunate enough and had enough gumption or you know, musical, I won't call it talent, a little bit of training, that I could adapt and write songs in different styles. So it wasn't just a case of what came out. Kevin Gavin, our manager, would come and say, hey, so-and-so called me last night, and this group or that artist is in the studio next week, and they need one more song for their album. Can you write something in this style?
Mm-hmm.
And we would run home and write something overnight, like Vic Damone. I don't know if many people in your audience remember him, but he
sure.
was a legit singer in the Italian style.
Yeah.
Was doing a Spanish album one time, and Kevin called us and said, Vic Damone's in the studio this week and needs one more tune. Can you give me something by tomorrow? So we ran out and bought a Spanish dictionary, you know, one of those little 2x3-inch jobs, and opened it to a page and pointed a finger, and there was this phrase, solamente amor, which means only love, you know, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And we wrote solamente amor, and he sang it the next day, and it's on his album.
Which brings us to a topic that I speak with many times with singer-songwriters who come on the show. You know, the singers, they do okay, but the songwriters do even better because they make money on these things whenever they're sung. So I assume that even now, some of the stuff you've written in the past is still making you some royalty checks.
It is. They're not big, and it's more a case of making some royalty checks again rather than still. Because for a long time, I was out of contact with the record industry. We wound up being hooked up with our final managers when we were successful finally. They sort of walked away with a lot of money that we had earned but never got paid.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they took it and retired to, I hear, the French Riviera on our money and the Tokens' money and the Happenings' money and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Very typical.
That was typical then, less typical now.
Right.
I got rather bitter about it and quit the music business completely, thinking this is filled with crooks and I don't want to be a part of it. So I let drop all my connections with the BMI and ASCAP and the organizations that collect the money for publishers and for songwriters, and I never told them all the moves that I had gone through. Now, if you don't let them know where you are, they can't send you your money.
Right.
They send it out to the last known address, then it goes back to them, and it sits there for a number of years, and then it's ole ole in free, and they keep it, and it goes into their retirement fund, which is fine, too, but it's not as though we're talking millions of dollars in our case. But it was very nice. 4 years ago, after we had put out our Ding Dong the Witch's collection, Ding Dong the Witch's Back collection, I reconnected with all those places because I had licensed some of the tunes.
Right.
For our own use, oddly enough, and gave them our current addresses. And then suddenly the next year, I got a big check for back royalties from Warner Brothers that went back almost 20 years.
Hmm. So that was kind of a nice found money.
Yeah, they went through all the accounts at Rhino, which they had bought in between time. And Rhino, of course, had nothing on paperwork from Jubilee, which was the original label owned by the schnooks who moved to the Riviera with $100. But they paid us what they could, and I was very grateful for it.
Hmm. That's at least a nice ending to the story anyway.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Now, I want to know a little bit about Boston Skyline. Tell me, you've created your own label, obviously.
Well, that's kind of an odd thing. Since I'm almost 60 years old, and I was very, very much a music person even in my early teens, and started listening to classical music and theater organ music and everything long before the Beatles happened, or at least a few years before the Beatles happened. And some of my favorite old LPs from that period never came out on CD. When CDs appeared, I waited and twiddled my thumbs and thought, oh, they'll be out, and they didn't come out. So I went investigating and found that several of them belonged to PolyGram, which is a major, big label.
Right.
And other labels of that sort. And I called their licensing departments and said, aren't you going to bring out this record or that record? And they said, no, who would ever want to hear that again?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, now, wait a minute, that was great music. You mean you're just going to let it, rot in the vault? And they said, yeah, we have no use for it. We're not going to bring it out. I said, well, license it to me. I'll put it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how Boston Skyline got started, was to basically reissue.
Kind of like the way Rhino started, but now Rhino's big business.
Yes. Well, I didn't have the backing to really do it on that scale. And I was primarily interested in classical stuff. Rhino and others were, by the time I started Boston Skyline in 1990, they were well into getting the entire rock catalog out and fixed up. And
between them and Sony Legacy and Sundazed, all these groups, they're all doing the same thing.
And there was clearly a bigger audience for that than for some relatively obscure classical records. But for instance, the one that contained the solo from Ding Dong the Witch is Dead, which was originally on Archive, which is a part of Deutsche Grammophon, unbeknownst to the people that run Deutsche Grammophon these days, had sold 250,000 copies when it came out. It was like the biggest selling Renaissance record ever released, ever. And nobody knew that. They had no files, no records. All they had was the tape on the shelf by an artist that nobody could really remember. And I said, let me put it out. And we sold 30,000 copies without blinking. So much that they were so surprised that they didn't re-grant our license on it. So we only had it for a while. But I'm very glad I did it, because an awful lot of people that recalled it fondly got a chance to get a copy on CD.
So once they found that it could actually sell, they decided, well, we'll put it out ourselves then, right?
Well, the strange thing is they didn't. They just didn't renew our license.
Unbelievable.
I assumed that they just wanted to get greedy and put it out themselves, and they owned the rights, and I was kind of irritated, but so be it. you know, after all, it would have been much cheaper and easier for me to go to the store and be able to buy a copy for $15 than spend $15,000 to put it out myself.
That's true.
They didn't. They just didn't re-grant us the rights, and there it sits in the vault again now.
Now, what happened to the original D-Men, some of the guys that you grew up with?
Everybody in the D-Men just became the Fifth Estate. We just renamed the group after our third or fourth label. And I'm in contact with all but one of them. We had a singer for a year and a half who actually was the lead singer with a countryish voice, Above Is All the Game and a few others. We did some Buddy Holly material, and he did a very nice job on it. His name was Chuck Legros, and he was with us for almost 2 years, and I don't know where he's gone. No one in the group has ever heard from him or about him since.
Huh.
So if he's listening to the show, Chuck, please give me a call. I'm in Boston. Everybody else is still in contact, and we get together periodically, as many as possible, to chew the fat and have a dinner. And
you guys ever get together to play anymore?
No. We tried a couple of times to find a date, and then, of course, nobody has equipment anymore. Our drummer became a lawyer and was quite successful. I understand he still has a set of drums, and he plays once in a while in his basement. The guitarist, we had two guitarists. One of them is a contractor who does condo developments and hasn't played in 20 years. Our bass player still plays and owns a little recording studio up in northwestern Connecticut, sorry.
All right.
It's just that everybody's sort of scattered to the wind.
Sure.
Hard to get them together. Joe Viglione, the Count, has asked us on a number of occasions to get together for an interview show on his
his public access TV show.
Yes, public access TV.
Visual TV or visual radio, isn't it?
Visual radio.
Yeah.
And I did an interview with him because I had done several books in connection with my teaching at Berklee, Berklee College of Music.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted us to get the group together, and we tried like hell to come up with two or three different dates, but it kept falling apart for one reason or another.
That would be great if you can do it.
It would, and I would enjoy it. I don't know if I'd want to hear us playing in retrospect, but, I mean, we'd give it a crack. I could probably still sing Boom Boom and a couple of other oldies or something.
Now, did you ever get married, have children and all that stuff?
I didn't. I've been on the road, essentially, since I was with the group. After the group broke up in 1970, Don Askew, who was our lyric writer, and I continued writing songs, and then we did music for films for a little while, and by that time I had started a motion picture production company with some guys from Dartmouth, other alumni that I graduated with.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to 15 years of being on the road shooting documentaries and commercials and sales films and educational films and several features, including, I don't know if you know, a director named John Sayles.
Sure.
We shot his first three feature films, including the one that got in the Time Magazine 10 Best, Return of the Secaucus 7.
Huh.
And Leanna, and I did a lot of work for him, and a couple of other people of that ilk who were doing low budget.
Are you still teaching now at Berklee?
Yes, I started teaching in Berklee in 82 for a couple of reasons. One, my back went out completely in the early 80s as a result of the heavy schedule of, 15, 18-hour days traipsing around with film equipment.
Right.
After 15 years. So my doctor said, look, if you want to walk, you got to lose 100 pounds, and you got to do, you got to do something more sedate. At the same time, Berklee College called and asked for a little report on whether they should be teaching anything like audio engineering or record production. And it was my opinion, of course, they should, but instead I suggested that they send me down to New York and interview some of their alumni and Quincy Jones and various people at the top of the industry. Who said, you mean they're not teaching it already? Get on the ball. So I did a report for them and a design for a department and six studios and, what kind of a faculty they would need. And I submitted it to them, and you know, they seemed happy with it, and I figured it's like most schools, I'd hear from them in a year, and they'd want a clarification on page 82 or something.
Uh-huh.
And instead, they called me the next week, maybe 2 weeks, when I was in the middle of mixing one of John Sayles' films in New York, and they said, how quick can you build all this? And I said, did you read the last page, which was a $2 million budget?
Uh-huh.
And they said, yes. And I said, well, I mean, have you got access to that kind of money to do this? They said, yes. How quick can you build it all? So I dropped everything and came up and hired several of my own people from our film company. There were about a dozen working in our film company at that time, and several other outside consultants and a contractor, and we built Berkeley a new department.
Wow.
Music production and engineering, and I began teaching there. So, you know, it's been kind of a random walk.
Yeah, we've had some friends of mine have gone there, including a very talented singer named Ashley Souza.
Yes, I know.
I don't know if you ever ran into her, but she's a wonderful young lady.
I did not work with her. I mean, we're down in the basement, like most recording studio programs. And frankly, I'm no longer full-time. I've had a lot of medical problems. Well, I've got mental problems, too.
Now, let's talk a little bit about when Ding Dong hit. Because as far as I'm concerned, and people think, say to me, oh, it's because you're an old guy, Mark. But, you know, I've always considered the mid-60s to the early 70s as really the best music around. And during the time in June, when Ding Dong hit the charts, songs like Groovin' by the Rascals and Windy by the Association, Somebody
That's
to
right.
Love, Jefferson Airplane, Happy Jack by The Who, and Sgt. Pepper was about to come out. I mean, we're talking about some amazing stuff that was out then. And Ding Dong did quite well against them.
Ding Dong did very well. We did it in 5 languages. I don't know if you were aware of that.
No.
The label, of course, decided that this was going to be an international hit because it took off so quickly. It was during the time of the flower power thing, and anything that was kind of fun and absurd really struck a nerve.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, it was fun and very absurd. So, and I always enjoyed wordplay anyway. So they hired a whole bunch of Berlitz teachers for one afternoon at the studio, and about every hour and a half, a new Berlitz teacher would come in and teach me how to sing the lyrics in Italian. Let's see, we did Italian, French, Spanish, German, and Japanese.
So now why didn't you put that on this album, the compilation album?
Because nobody could find any of the tapes.
Oh, that's too bad.
I would give a lot of money, I'd give a good deal of money for a copy of me singing Ding Dong the Witch's Dead in Japanese, among other things. I mean, we like to bury little jokes in things.
Uh-huh.
And, the background vocals in the record behind the verses go ooh la 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 in 3-part harmony.
Uh-huh.
In the Japanese version, we change it to ooh ra ra ra.
That's funny.
I
can't believe that there's nobody in the world that has that. I mean, you think with the internet that someone would have said, "Hey, Wayne, you know, over here in Osaka, we have a copy of this."
Oh, there must be someplace. I'm not adept enough at doing searches. I should just hire one of my students actually to do it.
There you go. Well, we're going to put a link up with this interview
on
our website.
Find me a copy. Joe Viglione tried, and he couldn't come up with one. Which surprised me, because he's Mr. Internet.
Yeah, he is. And well, we're going to put up a link with our site here with your interview.
Well, I would very much appreciate it if anybody anywhere in any kind of shape could find a copy in any of the languages that we did. It was just the one tune. We also later recorded Hi Ho in a couple of languages, but not all of those.
From Snow White?
Yes. The label, of course, thought, you could just keep cranking out these kiddie hits.
Of course. One thing works, they go with the same thing again.
Well, unfortunately, they don't, they're not very creative.
No.
As businessmen, they weren't very creative, and they didn't recognize that we're doing, I think, some reasonably good rock otherwise.
I agree with you. I think that I actually think a lot of it's really underrated. Some of it was good stuff.
Well, I mean, it got great reviews. When we brought out the compilation, the people at Goldmine and Discoveries all did, you know, they did 10, 15-page articles with huge amounts of pictures and featured the whole album in one of their issues and said, wow, why didn't anybody ever hear this?
Yeah, that's the way I felt when I listened to this, and you know, I thought it was really good stuff. It definitely, you can tell the British influence in the music.
Absolutely. Well, as I said, I mean, I don't consider myself a totally original thinker musically, but we were able to adapt and bring somewhat of our style to existing styles that were coming up. I mean, things were just happening faster than you could keep up with them then.
Mm.
So many great new artists coming up that were totally original. We were gasping trying to keep up with it all. And I remember when Sgt. Pepper came out, I hated it. I mean, I remember where I listened to it the first time in a dim basement apartment in New York, and I listened very intensely in a pair of headphones, and I thought, how could they do that? Now I have to learn all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, it was like a challenge.
Sure.
They were just throwing the gloves down and challenging everybody. In the way that, you know, there's this legendary battle between the Beach Boys and the Beatles to outdo each other.
Right.
It was true.
Yeah.
It was really a feeling of listen to this, take that.
Mm-hmm. And the Rolling Stones and the Beatles as well.
And
the
Stones,
competition there.
The Loving Spoonful,
yeah.
And you name it. I mean,
you know, did you watch Paul McCartney at the Super Bowl?
I did.
I thought he did a great job.
He did a wonderful job. I think that was him singing everything except on the first song he was singing the lower part of the voices on Drive My Car.
Uh-huh.
He sang the lower harmony live. But on everything else he sang in full voice, the real lead, in I think the original keys. I don't think any of them were changed.
Yeah, I thought he sounded really good. I was amazed.
He sounded like he used to sound. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I couldn't either. And many of us who grew up listening to that music were just thrilled listening to it.
And of course, very
happy with the Patriots' with victory as well.
The Patriots, that goes without saying. but it was a real treat for me to see McCartney, you know, doing a great job. Well backed up, without any particular flash, and nothing to cover up anything that might have been less than great musically. It was just good.
Who was the biggest group that the Fifth Estate ever toured with?
Oh, heck. We toured with the Buckinghams, we toured with the Easy Beats, we toured with Gene Pitney, we toured with The Happenings, people of that ilk.
Mm-hmm.
We never toured with the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. I met them.
You did?
Just very briefly. Mm. Their manager, Nat Weiss, the Beatles manager, not the Rolling Stones, wanted to sign our group. And so I was in and out of his office a few times, and one time the Beatles happened to be just coming into town, and they stormed into the office, followed by a dozen people, and we were introduced. And that was nice, and they were their usual jovial bounce around and make snide remarks self. that might have been 1966. It was long before the drugs and the, you know, it was right in the prime of their career.
Yeah.
As I said, you went into New York, you bopped into an office, and the next thing you know, you turned around and there was Carly Simon.
That's amazing.
Bringing a song for whoever she was writing for at that time. And you went into the next office and there was Donald Fagen. And you went into the next office and there was, you know, John Sebastian. Oh, hi, I'm John Sebastian. Oh, hi, I'm Wayne Wilde. Blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
It was all very much low-key and as as natural as could be. It was nothing highfalutin or, you know, hoity-toity about it or special. It just seemed like this is what was going on in order to make all this music happen.
You know, you guys wrote some pretty good songs together. And I understand at one point when all this stuff was happening with the bubblegum music, with the 1910 Fruitcake Company and Ohio Express and all that stuff, that they kind of force-fed you songs rather than using your own. They wanted to get into that same sugary mess.
Yes, they did. Well, I mean, based on Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, which they saw as a kiddie thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I must admit that a lot of the audience when we went out on tour that came to see us was preteen.
Yeah.
Probably younger than, of course, it would be for the Rolling Stones, who were writing R&B stuff, obviously, or even the Beatles. But, you know, our opinion was we can grow up a little bit here because, as a matter of fact, we are getting older, and we can do some more legit things. But they just never wanted to hear it. So ultimately, they, using a clause in our contract, which gave them control of our name, they just hired studio musicians, and they went on putting out records under our name, like the Parade of the Wooden Soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, none of us were even aware of that until we heard it on the air, and I was furious, and I hired a lawyer, but the lawyer said, when he looked at the contract, there's nothing you can do about it. And so that's when I quit. I just stopped being in the music business.
Because I'm looking at some of these things that you talk about in the compilation CD, and it's amazing to me. Well, I mean, like Do Drop In, which was a part of that release that we were just talking about, that's not on your compilation, I noticed.
But, no, it's not. There were certain songs that I couldn't get the rights to.
But then there's a story in here. You can tell me a little bit about this, about Alan Funt. You guys were contracted. You were supposed to go in there and actually sing in a session to update their theme song?
Oh, that was wild. This was pretty early on. It was really like 1965 when the Beatles had just hit, and everything had to sound like the Beatles to be successful. So Alan Funt wanted a Beatley version of the theme song from, what was the name of the show?
Candid Camera.
A Candid Camera. When it's least expected, you're elected, you're the star today. And we did it with Smile, you're on Candid Camera, ooh. You know, three-part
mm-hmm.
oohs.
Yeah, doing a little Beatlesque stuff.
Yeah, a little Beatlesque thing like that. But the original arranger who did the arrangements for those sessions hadn't done it that way and really didn't sound like he'd listened to the Beatles records at all because he had trombone arrangements. And when we got to the studio, and I was just hired as a backup singer at that point in time for that session,
mm-hmm.
And we did a run-through, it didn't sound at all like the Beatles. And I said, this is not, you know, what he asked for. And then Alan Funt, who was notorious for being difficult to work with and for, came into the session and said, oh, let me hear it. Just run it down. And we ran down the charts, and, of course, it sounded like, a big band arrangement with some vaguely Beatley lyrics
mm-hmm.
on top. And Alan Funt just stormed into the studio and said, you're all fired. Get the hell out of here. I don't want to, this is terrible.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, wait a minute. I mean, we could splice this thing down. All we need is, and I said, a guitar, a bass, a drum, what's in the Beatles? And give me Kenny Caron, who was the lead singer, and I'll rewrite the vocal charts, because I was like one of the only people in the rock end of the business who could read music a little bit, well
mm-hmm.
enough to do that at least. And in a half an hour, we banged together an arrangement, and he came back in and heard it and said, fine, because they needed something that had to be on the air like the following night.
Mm-hmm.
And they used it for 5 years, and it paid for my whole college education.
There you go. That's a good story, actually. It had a good ending.
It had a very good ending.
After the initial yelling and screaming, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was lucky, that I happened to be there and had the thought to try to help redo the damn thing rather than just can it and walk out the door and take my check and call it a dog. But that really helped my parents out a lot. I mean, it didn't pay for my whole college education, but it certainly, it kept generating royalties enough to really make it much easier on my folks to keep me in school at an expensive Ivy League place then. And you just never knew what you were going to get. We'd get asked to, I'd get a call. Who produced the Four Seasons? Why am I forgetting?
Giorgio or something?
No.
Marauder or something?
No. That's Donna Summer. The Four Seasons producer was always doing demos for this, that, or the other. And at one point, the guy who produced The Left Bank, whose name also escapes me right
yeah.
now, called and said, we have this song, and I know one of you guys plays harpsichord. It needs something sort of nostalgic sounding. come in and we're just doing a demo, put a little harpsichord on it. So I came in and they handed me a chord chart, which didn't even have the melody on it. There was no voice on the thing yet. And I played harpsichord over three or four instruments. And then about 2 months later, I hear it on the radio, and it's got lyrics, and it's called Walk Away Renee.
Wow, so you were on, did they use your music on the version? Wow. Did you get paid for that?
I was paid a session fee. I was a union musician, and I got my $113 or whatever it was.
Yeah, that's it. That was a great song, though. That was a nice thing to be part of.
But, yes, the thing was you just never knew what it was. I mean, one afternoon, we were booked into a studio just before the Love and Spoonful came in, and one of them was apparently ill, and somebody ran out into the studio while we were packing up to leave and said, does anybody play a tambourine? I said, well, I can play a tambourine. They said, come on in. And they pointed where they wanted, point at me for 8 bars and then say, shut up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a song called 6 o'clock.
Hmm.
So it was a light feeling of just sort of collaboration and camaraderie. And it was fun. It wasn't high art or anything like that. It was, I just can't explain how different it was then than it is now.
Well, I know, but some of the younger people listening don't. The people our age do know what's going on. I guess I wanted to ask you, do you have a website for folks to visit?
Just for the label. It's called Boston Skyline Records, and it's www.bostonskylinerecords.com.
Okay, because I'm going to send people over there. That's why
and,
I'm asking.
It's mostly classical, as you will find out. But it does include a compilation of our thing and one other group that I produced later who used to play a lot with Aerosmith and exchanged sets with them at bars up in New Hampshire. But Aerosmith became famous and these guys didn't.
What was that?
They did some very good things.
Who was that?
They were called Trax. They were pretty well known in this area. They did adaptations of a lot of early 70s stuff, including a rather famous version of Dylan's Watchtower.
Hmm.
Which we remixed for the compilation.
And which, of course, Jimi Hendrix did quite a version of himself.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, this was kind of an alternative, quasi-acid version of that, but really very eloquent. Their guitarist was quite phenomenal, and I was lucky enough to work with them for 3 or 4 years. We did 3 albums, but they never made it big.
Well, Wayne, it was a pleasure talking to you. We've run out of time here, but I'm going to send people to go to bostonskylinerecords.com. And if anybody out there listening has a copy of a foreign language version of Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, you can email Wayne right through that website. So,
you can. There's also just, it's bossskyline@aol.com is the direct email address, BOSSKYLINE. And I would love to hear from anybody, or just if you have a question or a comment or something silly, be in contact.
Well, thanks so much for coming on.
All right. Well, this was very enjoyable.
Thank you. Maybe
Thank
we'll
you
do it again sometime, Wayne.
Okay.
Take care.
Yeah. Bye-bye.